the Magna Carta. Carta, meaning quite literally charter, and Magna, meaning Japanese animation.
Oh, come on! A good lawyer couldn't win this case!
As is vampire law, we also have a local vampire here on the council this evening, Colin Robinson.
Hello.
How is it possible that you've never heard of O.J. Simpson?
Well, as I explained, I just awoke from a 22-year coma and was driven directly from the hospital to this courthouse.
You had no idea what tort reform meant, and when I asked you to explain the Sixth Amendment, you pled the Fifth.
I know my rights.
No, you don't. That's the problem.
Welcome to Opening Arguments, a podcast that pairs a comedian with a real-life lawyer. This podcast is sponsored by the law offices of P. Andrew Torres, LLC, for entertainment purposes, is not intended as legal advice, and does not form an attorney-client relationship. Don't take legal advice from a podcast.
Hello, and welcome to Opening Arguments. This is episode 591, apparently.
Yeah, don't touch that dial.
Yeah, that's Andrew. How you doing, Andrew?
I am still riding the high of this.
I expected
super
to just hear
deep dive on security.
Deep inhale. Okay, so Elon Musk, yeah, just go straight back into it and dispense with the pleasantries.
do my best Johnny Machida voice, you know, the Micro Machines man blur from Transformers.
No thing. Idea what you're talking about, but sure, yeah. No, great.
You've heard the guy who talks, who holds the world record for being the fastest talker.
Oh, so, cool. Yeah.
Just narrowly edging out no illusions. So,
yeah. There you go. All right, well, this is a bonus part two. Make sure, if you're seeing this on your feed, or if you're hearing this now, make sure you've listened to 590. I know sometimes podcast players just give you that latest one. Maybe you miss it. This is a part two. So if you haven't heard 590, which was the part one, this is, again, it's all impromptu. So, yeah, you know, don't blame you. If you haven't heard 590, go listen to that now and then come back to this one because this is a part two. An incredible deep dive on Elon Musk buying Twitter. So much more to talk about. So previously on Opening Arguments. Where do we leave off, Andrew?
Yeah, well, so we talked about the securities and exchange laws. We talked about why you have to disclose what you have to disclose. And what they disclosed here is a deal for Elon Musk to purchase Twitter at $54.20 a share with an anticipated close on or before October 24th, 2022. And now we've talked about all of the things that could go wrong from the perspective of Elon Musk and Twitter, and maybe go right if you have a different view, or hey, you know, go wrong if you think Elon Musk buying Twitter is the greatest thing ever. This is meant to be an explainer of what can and might and will happen over the next 6 months. So we talked about the approval by the shareholders. We talked about approval by the government. We talked about both sides kind of getting the deal up to the finish line. And we're going to kind of continue to discuss that. One of the things that I love the most that is buried in this deal, and I've seen a couple of other people point this out because it's just so incredibly odd. But I want to give you the right context for this. And this is, we talked about how the deal contains certain representations and warranties between the parties. This is very, very common on a large transaction because, for example, one of the things that you represent and warrant is that the documents you exchange about the company are true and correct. And that period is called the due diligence phase. And that is, so I will say, you know, suppose it's a non-public company. You're looking to buy Opening Arguments Media LLC. And you would say, hey, in order to figure that out, I want to know how many Patreons do you have? How much, you know, how many ads did you sell? This and that. And I, as the selling, you know, you and I, as the sellers, have to disclose that information. And we can disclose it in sort of, you know, whatever form that is appropriate. We could also lie, right?
Oh, like, cool.
Yeah, we have a million patrons.
Wait, are you saying we're allowed to lie, or this is a thing?
No, I'm saying sometimes people do lie.
Ah, gotcha.
And when they do lie, one of the ways in which you protect against them lying is you specifically put in a section that says covenants. The seller's covenant that the relevant financial documents that they have exchanged with the buyers are true and correct to the best of their ability. And so, if I've overstated our patrons by a factor of several thousand, then Elon Musk can back out of having to pay us billions of dollars for Opening Arguments Media LLC. That's all very, very commonplace. Mm-hmm. And when I look at the covenants, the things that each side promises to do, there's a lot of things that are boilerplate that you just would, you know, normal kind of stuff you expect to see in these big deals, right? Continue to run the business properly. You got to call your stockholders meeting if you're Twitter. You have to file all the regulatory documents that you need to file. And then I get to section 6.8, which is public announcements. The first part of this reads absolutely normal from any business deal that I've ever seen. That is, in terms of the public statements about the deal, that both sides are required to come together and confer and cooperate before releasing any information. That's totally normal. And then there's this line, and I swear to God, not making this up. Notwithstanding the foregoing, the equity investor, that is Elon Musk, shall be permitted to issue tweets about the merger or the transactions contemplated hereby, so long as such tweets do not disparage the company or any of its representatives. So yes, there is an "our investor is an asshole" on Twitter clause in this merger agreement. And I will point out, arguably, Elon Musk has already violated this provision.
Ooh.
And look, you can understand how this provision got negotiated. Because obviously, if Elon Musk puts in a tender offer at $54.20 and then spends the next 6 months saying Twitter's the worst business on earth, it's so terribly run, like there's this and that, it's just, right? Like that's driving down the stock price of the company when a heavily involved, when the purchaser has every incentive to drive down the stock price of the company. So that's why that's in there to sort of backstop. But I find it interesting that the lawyers had to go back and forth and say, all right, well, you can't expect him not to badmouth you at all. we can't keep Elon Musk off of the thing that he's buying here. That's why he's buying. And then Twitter's lawyers came back and were like, fine, but he can't disparage us while he's tweeting about this. Come on. And ultimately they agreed to that.
You argue that he's violated that. What's going to happen? I mean, I was just like trying to look through his tweets, which is, I'm mad at the show and you for making me look at anything Elon Musk said because he's an idiot. But one of them is Truth Social is currently beating Twitter and TikTok on the Apple Store. I mean, is that disparagement? He's saying it's Twitter's doing worse than Truth Social. He's saying that Twitter isn't an adequate free speech platform. You know, is that what you're talking about? Or is there something else I'm missing here?
That's what I'm talking about. And this illustrates the principle that we talked about in the last episode, okay, which is to say, in and of itself, that is not going to cause Twitter's board of directors to back out on the deal. However, you can bet that Twitter's legal department has saved each and every one of those tweets and will save each and every tweet that Elon Musk issues between now and October 24th, 2022, because in the event that they do decide to back out, they will not just say, oh, yeah, well, we got a better deal, so we agree we're going to pay you the $1 billion. They're going to say, we don't have to pay you that $1 billion because you violated a covenant, a promise that you made to us. You said you weren't going to disparage us. And here's the 105 examples of you disparaging us over the course while this deal was headed to close. And does saying Gab is beating Twitter on what, you know, whatever that, like that nonsense, does that count as disparagements? Well, that is a matter for the courts to decide. And again, will that be litigated out to every conceivable pixel that forms every character in that agreement? Of course it will be, because what will be at stake is $1 billion. And so if you pay your lawyers $50 million to litigate that to death, you're still way, way, way ahead than where you would have been by just paying the $1 billion like a dingus, you know? So when I tell you that coat factory law firms are the cause of overcrowding in the courts, this is Exhibit A. Because as we're walking, none of these cases have been filed yet, but it is trivially easy to imagine how they would be filed. And the way in which they would be filed is business makes a decision and then goes back and looks for ways to have the law potentially hedge against them paying the maximum that that decision would otherwise require them to pay. And because the cost of litigation is fractional compared to the damages that they've allegedly incurred, every single one, like, why wouldn't you? Right. Mm-hmm. Before you write a $1 billion check, you know, would you pay a proofreader, you know, $500 an hour to make sure that the check is typed properly? Sure, you would. Right. Like there's literally nothing you wouldn't expend to try and protect against having to issue that. So that could happen. And that provision in there is an incredibly strong provision that, you know, again, people have a couple folks noticed it, but have noticed it as sort of a, isn't this funny that there's a, you know, Elon Musk has to agree not to disparage the company that he's acquiring. That has real consequence. It makes it materially easier for the board of directors to reverse course here.
Well, and now they think about it from Elon's perspective. Let's see. I mean, it would further ensure the sale would go through if the stock price dips. Weirdly, right? Because then shareholders are going to be like, oh, I can either take $54.20 or whatever the hell it's worth now.
Yep.
On the other hand, I suppose by that same logic, then Elon will be overpaying for Twitter by that amount. But I guess if he's taking it private, I don't know. That's a complicated calculation. I don't know.
And that calculation, when we talk about the bottom line, it's what I want to end with because I've done a lot of work on this and I think it's pretty interesting. But yeah, I know there is the tendency, there certainly is the tendency for me to do this. You're talking about somebody worth in excess, somewhere between $100 and $200 billion, buying a thing for $40-odd billion. Like those numbers don't seem real.
Yeah.
The economy doesn't seem real. But what I want you to know is that there is a gravity to the transaction that is a mismatch to the apparent lack of seriousness with which this is being treated by Elon Musk himself. A real easy way to think about that is figure out your net worth.
That's funny. I was going to make the same thing.
Yeah. And again, now for 50% of America, that's zero.
Negative for a lot of people. Yeah.
Or negative, zero or worse. But suppose you're one of our older listeners and you own your own house.
Yeah, or you bought a house in the 70s for $12 and a sack of beans. And now it's worth...
Now it's worth $1 million. Yeah, exactly. And you've got retirement and this, and let's say you're worth, you know,
$3 million.
Yeah.
Why not?
But I was trying to do multiples of five here, but
let's say you're worth $2,785,000 and four.
Yeah. If you have that, if you have $2 to $3 million in equity, what would a $500,000 to $600,000 transaction look like to you? Well, that would be buying a new house.
Wouldn't it be more than that?
I was saying 1/5. So 600,000 times five
is only 1/5. If he's worth $100 billion to almost half.
Yeah.
That's a wide range. I thought he was worth $100 billion. Okay.
Most of his value is tied up in Tesla stock, which we're going to talk about in the last segment. But yeah. So imagine you're that person between 20% and 50% of your wealth. That's a staggering, like, you know, it's not just big numbers, right? They're big relative numbers. So people seem to think that Elon Musk is not being capricious here. I don't see any evidence of that. This seems to me to be the kind of thing that, you know, 2 months from now, he might say, yeah, I'm willing to risk $0 to $1 billion to get out of this thing that's going to handcuff me.
Well, I could imagine. I mean, as you say, most of his wealth tied up in Tesla stock. Let's say he buys this. That's, as we've illustrated, a solid chunk of his wealth. Could be anywhere from half to a fifth at minimum. And it doesn't go well. And say the Tesla stock plummets for some reason. I mean, that's only a couple steps away from him being worth significantly less than he's worth right now. That would be, could be catastrophic for him.
I'm actually going to skip to that right now because I think thematically this makes sense, because it is more than just Elon Musk becoming uncomfortable with this. So let's break down the exact numbers, because I've done this.
Why don't you just tell me the exact numbers then? Okay.
$44 billion is a lot. Mm-hmm. Even for Elon Musk. And so in the 8K, Twitter's had to describe, here's how we're going to get that $44 billion.
Twitter's had to describe?
Yeah.
Twitter's, oh, I thought you 8K. Meant like Elon needs to get that amount of money to buy Twitter, right?
He does, but they have to, Twitter has to tell its shareholders, this is where the money is coming
from. Okay.
You can't just say, we'll let Elon figure out how to pay us $44 billion.
Interesting.
You have to say exactly where you're going to get it from. So the first is, he has to come up with $21 billion in cash at close.
Go through a lot of couch cushions.
That's a lot of couch cushions.
Yeah.
The way
but he owns
which,
a lot of couches, though.
The way in which Elon Musk, and you just Google Elon Musk sells Tesla stock, Elon Musk is down to owning just 17% of Tesla stock. That's because every time he needs money, he sells Tesla stock. That's his best asset. Now, your financial advisors will tell you selling off your best asset to buy a worse asset is not a great financial move. But number one, he's got to come up with $21 billion in cash. And again, the equivalent of that is, think about if you're buying a home, you had to come up with a down payment of half the home's purchase price. That's what he's got.
I could not do that. Yeah.
I could not do that. Next, he's got $13 billion in direct debt financing. And again, let's stick with the buying a home example. That's like the mortgage, okay? So this is what banks, and it's multiple banks, are willing to lend Elon Musk, secured by Twitter shares themselves, secured by the asset. And so it's exactly like the money you borrow from the bank to take the mortgage on your home.
Even if after it's private, it will still be secured by this, by Twitter.
Exactly right, by the shares of Twitter. And so just like banks are not in the business of owning homes, banks are also not in the business of owning social media companies. But nevertheless, that is secured by the asset that is being purchased. And I've seen some lefty sources that are like, well, I don't get why he gets to, and he gets to secure it by the asset being purchased in the same way that when you buy a home, you get to secure by the asset being purchased. But that still leaves a pretty huge gap. And that gap is covered by a third kind of loan, and that is $12.5 billion.
Loan.
Yep, kind of.
He just takes his Tesla paycheck to the payday loan place. Hey, can I get $20 billion? 25% interest a day.
So kind of. This is $12.5 billion in margin loan financing for X Holdings 3. That's a callback to the last episode. Remember I told you there was a third
his kid.
X Holdings company, which is another empty Musk shell company that is secured by Elon Musk's Tesla stock. Now, you might recall the Tesla stock is already going to be the source for the $21 billion to begin with. He also needs to pledge a sufficient amount of shares to cover the $12.5 billion margin loan financing here. Now, how much does he have to pledge? This is actually a doubly complicated question, because there is an amount that is disclosed in the merger document, and that is disclosed as a 20% loan to value. Okay. So, really straightforward, that means at closing, he's got to be able to demonstrate to the bank that he has $62.5 billion in Tesla stock. Now, right now, he owns 172.6 million shares. And it was trading at the time of this, at the time of the deal, at $1,000 a share.
And notably, it has plummeted 20% in the last month.
It has. And as Tesla stock plummets, two things happen.
Yeah.
Number one, it jeopardizes 1 and 3. It jeopardizes, he's got to sell more shares to come up with the $21 billion. And he's got to put up more shares to get the $12.5 billion in the gap financing. Also, you notice I called this margin loan financing. What that means is, as the stock itself is volatile, if the stock continues to drop after the date, you have to either put up more stock as collateral or pay more, pay off the loan with actual hard cash in order to keep the loan to value under the appropriate number. Yeah. Right. And sitting on top of all of that, those are the requirements of the bank, right? So the bank can issue a margin call if the price on Tesla stock continues to drop and you've got to pay the bank money. Think about the plot of trading places. On top of all of that are the rules that Elon Musk has to follow as a Tesla shareholder. Now think about that for a second.
Quote unquote has to follow. Yeah, sure.
I can tell you what the law is.
The man breaks these rules all the time though, right? Am I wrong about that?
You are not wrong about that, but you're
not. But I know, I'm not criticizing you.
No, criticism not taken, because I don't listen. No, that's not what I meant. I have seen, and Elon Musk has said, you know, I have contempt for the SEC and I'm not going to pay their fines.
Yep.
The difference between fines that were incurred in the past and the fines that would be incurred in connection with this deal are orders of magnitude.
Oh, okay,
yeah.
Cool.
So way, way, way more serious. Criminal penalties as a backstop for fraudulent disclosures, and we read you the 10b-5 rules. And perhaps more importantly, and again, this is kind of terrifying, but if this goes south because of something that Elon Musk does, then you would have not just the SEC interested, but Twitter, a very, very valuable company with coat factory lawyers itching to tell Twitter to go sue Elon Musk. So there are a number of things that kind of backstop against just kind of cavalierly being like, the law doesn't apply to me here. And having an equally large corporation on the other side backed by civil lawsuits is sadly a potential deterrent. So now let's go back to Tesla's own rules. And this would add another group into the mix, because if Elon Musk violates his fiduciary duties to his shareholders, and again, that's the 83% of people who own the rest of Tesla, you would get a very enterprising plaintiff's law firm to gather together shareholders to sue Elon Musk for breach of fiduciary duty.
Morgan Stringer, get on it.
Yeah.
No,
she's a little busy right now, but yeah. But in its last proxy statement, right, the last time the shareholders took a vote, Tesla set forth its policy on what board members can do with Tesla stock. And first, let's explain that the reason for that is, and you've alluded to this previously in this episode, what the largest shareholder does with respect to his holdings of that company materially affects the price of the stock, right?
Yeah.
When Elon Musk sells a bunch of Tesla stock, the price drops. When Elon Musk is over-leveraged with respect to Tesla stock, then the risk is that that will default to the bank, and then the bank will engage in a forced sale of the stock, which, again, just like banks don't want to own homes and operate social media companies, they don't want to own huge portfolios of Tesla stock. They force sell them off. That winds up, everybody knows, like the market just knows that those are sold at a discount, and again, drives the price of the stock down. So because you have a fiduciary duty to your shareholders, you have to put into place policies to protect them from you doing something stupid that would tank the value of their stock. And here's what Tesla put into place. In order to mitigate the risk of forced sales of pledged shares, the board of Tesla has a policy that limits pledging of Tesla stock by our directors and executive officers. Pursuant to this policy, directors and executive officers may pledge their stock, exclusive of options, warrants, restricted stock units, or other rights to purchase stock. That's an important asterisk, right? That's to say, you may only pledge your actual shares. You can't say, I'm going to vote myself this incentive and then secure the loan based on those incentives, right? No, they have to be your real shares. As collateral for loans, provided that the maximum aggregate loan or investment amount collateralized by such shares does not exceed 25% of the total value of the pledged stock. So in other words, even though the loan for Twitter has a loan to value of 20%, that is 5-to-1. Tesla requires that you not exceed 4-to-1, which means that for $12.5 billion, you've got to pledge at least $50 million in stock. Well, that's less than the $62.5 million, but that provides the margin call backstop. They even have an example. They say a director pledges 1,000 shares as collateral for a loan, and the current stock price is $800 per share. The director may borrow up to 25% of $1,000 times 800, or $200,000 against such shares. If the stock price then increases to $1,600 per share, the director may borrow another $200,000. Mm. If the director borrows the full allowable amount of $400,000 against the $1,600 and the stock price decreases to $1,200, the director must repay $100,000 of the loan to maintain compliance with the 25% limit under the pledging policy. So as the stock price of Tesla drops, not only does that limit the amount of cash that Elon Musk can raise, not only does that increase the amount of stock he has to put up as collateral for the loan, but it potentially triggers the margin call if it drops further of the bank saying, hey, you're outside of the maximum allowable ratio, not just by our loan, but also by your company policy. And we are issuing a margin call. We are requiring that you tender to us X billion dollars immediately in order to bring yourself into compliance.
What's the granularity on that? I mean, is that every minute? Because stock prices change every minute. Is there some time period interval that they check it or some threshold?
That's a great question. And that is up to the terms of the loan in terms of when they can issue the call. But typically what happens is when you dip below a certain level, that triggers the right to issue a margin call. So even if that trigger level is X number, and then all of a sudden you issue the margin call, even if the stock has crept up above that level, you have the right to make that demand and to foreclose on the securities if the margin call is not met. My quick math suggests, 50 over 62.5 suggests that's 0.8, suggests that if Tesla stock drops to $800, which it has dropped to 826, is the lowest I have seen since the announcement of the deal. Very real possibility.
Yeah.
That may be, I may be doing the wrong math. I will link a Bloomberg article, which estimates that the drop dead price is $740 a share.
Hmm.
That would require, again, further sell-off. But that's not an impossible number to imagine in the next 6 months.
Right.
And so you would wrap all of this together as kind of a third area where there is a significant chance, based on the financing and based on the health of Tesla. And the more Elon Musk acts erratic in public, the lower the value of Tesla stock goes. Right.
Yeah.
The way to think about that is the Fabulous Future Stock episode of Futurama. When your CEO is doing crazy things in public, investors are like, well, that doesn't look good for this company. So that's a third area to think about in terms of this deal having some difficulties associated with it. There are additional ways in which Twitter could give Elon Musk the right to pull out and get his $1 billion.
Hmm.
And that is, if at any time in the next 6 months there is a material adverse effect, what's that? That's defined as any change, event, effect, or circumstance which individually or in the aggregate has resulted in or would reasonably be expected to result in a material adverse effect on the business, financial condition, or results or operations of the company and its subsidiaries taken as a whole. In other words, if something comes up in the next 6 months that makes Twitter look less valuable than it does today.
Mm.
Now, as you might imagine, a whole lot of stuff is excluded from that, right? So a lot of this is boilerplate. Any condition, change, effect, or circumstance generally affecting the industries or markets in which the company operates, i.e. Mm-hmm. broad-based sweeping legislation targeting social media companies, they would be exempted from that. Any change in the law or GAAP, general economic, regulatory, political conditions or changes therein, right? All of that stuff, they are exempted from any acts of God, force majeure, operations of pandemics, epidemics, contagious disease outbreaks, including COVID-19, any political or social conditions, including civil unrest, protests, public demonstrations under COVID-19. So all of that, pretty normal exclusions. And then some are exclusions that are written in just as a result of the fact that it is Elon Musk. And you're saying, are you sure about that? And I would point you here to this. Again, this is section 6.5, material adverse effect. Subsection 6 is, This does not count as a potential material adverse effect. The negotiation, execution, announcement, performance, consummation, or existence of this agreement, or the transactions contemplated by this agreement, including subsection A, by reason of the identity of Elon Musk, the parent company, or any of their affiliates or respective financing sources. Now, I just want to point out what a genius provision this is in the acquisition. This is saying, hey, when this deal becomes public, if everybody says, oh my gosh, Elon Musk is going to ruin Twitter, and that reduces the value of the business, that's not a reason for you to back out from the deal, Elon Musk.
Yeah, that's kind of on you.
Yeah, it is. There's more that is contained in those restrictions. But again, I thought that was an interesting provision that's like, no, we're not going to let you agree to buy us, tank the value of our stock, and
just
then claim,
by being you and being like, oh, what happened? Take this back.
So that represents kind of a fourth bucket. Like something happens and Twitter becomes way less valuable in the next 6 months. That gives Elon Musk not only the right to back out, but the right to demand $1 billion while backing out. What about on the flip side? I was going to go straight here, but I'm glad we did the discussion of, I think it flowed organically to the discussion of the value of Tesla stock. We talked about how this is a contract. And so what if Twitter gets a better offer? Hmm. Remember that whole fiduciary duty thing? Suppose somebody comes along and is like, I'll pay you $60 a share. Well, we would absolutely want, right? The efficient markets hypothesis would say, yeah, we want Twitter to break that deal with Elon Musk, sign the new deal at $60 a share, and fine.
Pay the $1 billion.
Pay the $1 billion. This deal has skids in place to make that less likely. Because again, remember, the $1 billion is $1.25 in the share price, right? So you would think, hey, we got 54.20, let's shop that around. If we can do 55.50 or better, you know, we're going to take that deal instead. And I want to tell you, this kind of a provision is standard in these kinds of agreements for exactly the reason that I've just described. You don't want to get a firm deal in hand and then say, great, thank you for making me that firm deal in hand. Now I'm going to shop that around to everybody else and use that as the minimum offer. Because then business transactions would never get done, right? Like everybody would just be the pawn for the next guy. So Section 6.5 has a section called adverse board recommendation change. Again, remember, these are all conditions that require Twitter to pay the $1 billion. But that is, Twitter looks at it and is like, yep, we got a better deal. We're going to pay you the $1 billion, not sell to you, sell to somebody else. So we already talked about the first set of these provisions. That is, they can't make public statements not to sign the deal. They can't make public statements that would encourage somebody to take some other deal.
Who is bound by that? Because there's the board, there's the CEO, there's even Jack.
Yep.
Who I imagine must still own stock but doesn't run anything anymore, was making positive statements about Elon, which I found baffling, but whatever. Could that be because of this? Or like, who's actually bound by this obligation not to trash talk Elon?
Yep. Great question. It is the board by and through its agents or representatives. So yeah, if you are a high-ranking official at Twitter but not on the Twitter board of directors, you can absolutely publicly lobby against this.
Do it.
So, general rule that says you can't encourage the stockholders not to vote for this deal. Then it says, notwithstanding anything in this agreement to the contrary, at any time prior to their approval, in response to an event, occurrence, change, effect, condition, development, or state of facts or circumstances that was neither known to nor reasonably foreseeable by the board as of the date of this agreement, if the company has received a competing proposal, and that's capital CP, competing proposal, that the company board has determined in good faith constitutes a superior proposal. So let me stop for a second and define that. A competing proposal is defined in the agreement itself as a proposal made by a third party on terms that the company board determines in good faith after consultation with its legal counsel and financial advisors, and considering such factors as the company board considers to be appropriate, are more favorable to the company's stockholders than the transactions contemplated by this agreement. And if that is for 90% or more of the shares, that becomes a superior proposal. So it's a competing proposal. If somebody else comes in and wants to buy 15% of your stock, it's a superior proposal. If the board says, if the offer is for 90% or more and the board says, yeah, this is better than the Twitter deal. So now you're looking at it going, okay, so all right, they can't tell the board not to vote for this proposal, but they can go out and gather information and then make a recommendation if there is a superior proposal. And the answer to that is yes, with two more restrictions on it. The first is a non-solicitation provision. This is section 6.5, and it says, first, you have to stop all existing conversations with anybody that you've ever had with respect to buying Twitter. So the company shall not solicit, initiate, knowingly encourage, or knowingly facilitate, whether publicly or otherwise, any substantive discussion or offer or request that constitutes or would reasonably be expected to lead to a competing proposal. So you can't talk to anybody you have in the past. You cannot solicit or engage in any kind of discussion that would lead somebody to make a new offer. You may not engage in negotiations or substantive discussions or, and this is the second half of it, furnish any material non-public information to any person relating to a competing proposal or any inquiry or proposal that would reasonably be expected to lead to a competing proposal. That will make it very hard to get a better deal in the next 6 months. But let's assume, kind of against all odds, that somebody comes in and, on the basis of public information alone, says, okay, I'm going to beat this deal. I know, I've read it. I understand you can't give me any additional information. You can't solicit. But nevertheless, I want to offer $60 a share for Twitter. Put whatever pie in the sky schemes you've seen floating around on the internet.
Imagine why that would be, but sure.
Yeah. There's still one more clause in there, and that is a right of first refusal. If there is a superior proposal, you have 4 days. You have to offer Elon Musk the right to beat it. And if he can say, no, I'm just going to walk away and take the billion. we call that the whip clause. Yeah. Right? Or he can say, no, I want you to sit down and we have 4 days to hammer out a deal in which both sides have to exercise good faith in letting me match those terms. So at the end of all of the day, right? So I've gone through this section because I've seen like, well, let's crowdsource and fund. And if everybody on Twitter pays.
All right, opening arguments. Let's crowdsource $60 billion. No.
We've raised some good money in the past, but yeah. $60 billion would be a challenge.
Might be out of reach.
Here's the thing. If opening arguments crowdsourced and raised $60 billion and we took that, we wouldn't need 60, but I was saying $60 a share. That would be, $50 billion. That's
yeah, okay. Easy.
Now, oh, right. Yeah.
Sorry, I shouldn't have messed up.
60, we can't. 50 yeah. billion, that would not be it. That would be, stand on our heads. We could raise the 50 billion. We could offer them 60 odd dollars a share, and they would have the obligation to take that to Elon Musk and say, hey, opening arguments is going to give us $60 a share. And then Elon Musk could just say, okay, I'll give you $60 a share. So, in other words, that would not be guaranteed to stop the transfer even in any event. Now, put that alongside the financing obligations, right?
It's so going to be go back out to the electrical college and
right.
and
if Elon Musk is going to have trouble raising the $44 billion, he's going to have even more trouble raising the $50 billion, but he has the right to do that. So the only things that I've seen that, have struck me as farcical when I saw them, like crowdsourcing from Twitter or what have you. But that is not the way to block this deal because of the provisions that are on Twitter's side. So put all of that together. That's sort of how I evaluate it. The deal is not done. There is some risk priced into the markets that it does not get completed. I don't want to tell you that this is, it's 50-50 or that it's likely to fall apart. The markets certainly don't reflect that. The markets reflect a reasonable level of confidence, but something shy of certainty. And we've kind of detailed the way in which, in particular, I would say if the deal falls through, it will be because Elon Musk pulls out and not because Twitter pulls out. I think Twitter has agreed. They've said, look, we have a fiduciary duty to our shareholders. And by the way, I want to break that down a little because I've mentioned this several times and it's a very high-minded sounding thing. But let me point out the cynical flip side of fiduciary duty to our shareholders. to sit on the board of directors of a company typically requires you to be a large shareholder in the company. Mm-hmm. So when you say our fiduciary duty is to maximize the return on the shares of...
I'm but a servant for all of you shareholders.
Yeah. And also I own 10% of the stock.
Yeah, 90% of the company.
Right. So that fiduciary duty is to get the most money that they possibly can. Yeah. Let's not overly romanticize late stage capitalism here. But I think they've looked at the deal and said, they've come up with... what goes all the way back to what you said at the beginning of episode 590, which is, feels like an overpay, feels like a lot of money, and so let's take it. And I recommend we take the offer.
There's nothing that mandated that they had to accept an offer just by virtue of it being an offer. It's just that they all probably want money on the board. Or
yeah, again, business judgment rule. This is a tremendous way to wrap up the entire discussion. We started with, this is not a hostile takeover. Mm-hmm. This is a merger. A merger requires approval by the board of directors and approval by the shareholders. And so the board of directors is free to say, when Elon Musk says, I'll give you $54.20 per share, to say, you know what? We think in the next 3 years, we're going to get $60 a share.
Does anything force the vote of the shareholders though?
Nope.
Cause like, okay. So when the board, it's a ratchet. When the board says yes, subject to a vote on the shareholders. But when the board says no, do we never get that far?
The way in which you get there is are two different ways. The first is if the mismatch is sufficiently large. Let's say the board says to Elon Musk, not at 54.20, and he goes, okay, how about 60? And they go, no, not at 60. And he says, all right, how about 80? And they say, no, not at 80. At that point, at some point, that makes the hostile takeover the better option. You say, really? Like, the stock's trading at 35 right now. I'm pretty sure if I go to the shareholders and offer them $60 a share, I'm going to get 60% immediately. Then I can fire all of you idiots, replace them with people that I appoint to the board, and that will make
Could he do a lowball price after that?
This would be an entire separate episode on two-step
Part
mergers.
Three.
Yeah. seriously, Google two-step mergers and feel free. That's separate OA homework. But you could do a hostile takeover, replace the board, and then tee up a second stage merger where you then freeze out, acquire all of the, or other means to acquire all of the rest of the shares. It's more complicated. I am grossly oversimplifying. Please, M&A lawyers, don't at me for oversimplifying here. But feel free to write in if I've missed something, but I don't think I have. So that's the first kind of way of backstopping that, right? If the board is just being obstinate, you could go the hostile takeover route. You could also go the shareholder action route. Like, there is a point at which, again, we've talked about the business judgment rule, in which
they could like sue the board for not taking.
Yeah,
this
they could sue the board for being unreasonable in getting 100, 200 cents on the dollar for their shares, twice what any reasonable person would offer. Again, subject to all of the difficulties that we've described in that, but remember that Elon Musk put himself in that position, became a substantial shareholder in Twitter. So he could initiate that lawsuit just on the basis of his own shares.
That's the next thing I was going to ask is, did he just goof, or what happened? Because like, it's from everything you've said, it doesn't sound like there's any reason why he needed to try to buy that 10% initially. Was that just like he was starting a hostile takeover and then he kind of got caught and then went this alternate route?
It's super hard to know, but if you ask me to speculate, I would say it is some combination of initiating the hostile takeover and then changing your mind, or if you are...
He may have just wanted to get on the board, I guess.
To say the best way to have all of your options open is to be able to turn around when you've made the tender offer and say, well, look, like, I could just engage in a hostile takeover here. And to already have 10% of the shares of stock puts you in a superior bargaining position when you're at the table.
Plus, there's sort of the dastardly angle that, again, I alluded to in the first episode. I'm pretty sure that he's possibly in trouble for this, but I don't know what kind of trouble he's in. He bought those shares at artificially low prices because people didn't know he was doing this whole thing. So he was able to accumulate 10% at pretty significantly lower prices than it's currently trading at.
Yeah. Absolutely. That is a thing where, and again, you can point to failure to pay penalties in the past. I will point to real folks who have gone to real prison and done real time for
real
violations of 10b-5. If that is the case, that there is material non-public information that was available at the time when Elon purchased those shares that was not disclosed. Look, that's the classic textbook case of how people go to prison.
Billionaires for prison 2022.
Billionaires for prison 2022. I'm 100% behind that. And look, that one's real easy to figure out, because if you buy up the shares at 30 and then you've made this offer and now you back out now that the shares are at 50, right?
Yeah.
That's way in excess of that $1 billion penalty.
Interesting.
And you've done that just by pump and dump. And that is one of the oldest schemes, you know, known to the stock market.
What's the percentage chance you think this is pump and dump?
I couldn't begin to speculate. But it's not zero.
Yeah.
It's not zero. So, yeah. And if that's the case, again, I can't promise you, just like I couldn't promise you Trump is going to prison. I still hope so. I can't promise you Elon's going to prison. I can tell you that lots of people have gone to prison over way less than that.
Well, he can just say he doesn't remember that. I don't recall. Don't remember any of this. And then you're like, well, you're free to go because you're not a black man being railroaded by the justice system.
Very true.
Well, what a deep dive. Weirdly, we could have gone more.
Oh, yeah. I still have more, but
I know, and I still have a couple more questions. I think it's interesting that it kind of caps the stock price for 6 months. Isn't that weird?
Yeah.
I'm thinking through kind of broadly what that means, but like making an offer on an extended deal like this, nobody would possibly pay more than, you know, X amount of dollars or whatever you said, you know, 50, something short of 5420 for like 6 months. So they're essentially capping their growth. I guess as a shareholder, I might be kind of upset by this, especially if the deal doesn't go through, because then you're paying $1 billion. You could be, depending on who stops the deal, paying $1 billion as a shareholder, you know, $1.50 or whatever the price was per share. And then also the stock price has been like artificially capped for 6 months. That's really interesting.
Yeah. And remember, if the deal goes through, your stock is liquidated.
That's fascinating to me. How is it just mechanically? I guess I already know the answer to this, but it's just so interesting that someone could hold a thing, a piece of paper or whatever, a digital thingy that says, I own this whatever percentage of this company, and be against this merger, this takeover, this whatever, but then they're just forcibly cashed out if, I guess, 50.1% of the other shareholders vote to do this weird merger thing. It's just weird. Fascinating to me.
And there's an asterisk on that that could be an entire episode on its own. But
Part 7.
Yeah. But yes, when the shareholders approve of the conversion event that includes the minority and dissenting shareholders who were against it.
Is it a 50.1% thing?
It will be a 50.1% thing here.
Is there a threshold for voting? Like if I have one share, could I go spend $49 right now to have a vote in this?
You absolutely can.
So even owning one share means you...
Yep.
Is your vote, I guess, is it times the number of shares
one
you
share,
have?
One share, one vote. Yeah, that's...
So, okay, that's really interesting. All right, well, endless questions, and we still have a couple things we wanted to do in this episode that I'm somehow turning around in like a day. So why don't you give us those quick news updates that I know you were dying to give us?
The first is we went through Tuesday's episode. I was going to say last episode. That's what it says in my notes.
Yeah, not true.
No longer true. on the contempt proceedings against Donald Trump. In between that episode being recorded, coming out, and now we have a ruling from Judge Engoron that has held Trump
who
in
has,
contempt.
Yeah. Say it with me now. Nothing but contempt for this Trump.
And those are sanctions of $10,000 per day until Trump complies with the court's prior discovery orders. We told you, look, this is a good way to get a reading on what the court thinks about these competing allegations. Well, here's what the court thinks of the competing allegations. It says, this begins on page 2, instead of producing the documents called for in the subpoena, on March 31st, Mr. Trump produced 16 pages of boilerplate objections and a 4-page page affirmation by counsel that states, summarily, that Mr. Trump was unable to locate any responsive documents in his custody. The affirmation fails to identify what search methods were employed, when they were employed, where they were employed, by whom they were employed, and when such searches took place. OAG, Office of the Attorney General, has moved to hold Mr. Trump in contempt and asked this court to impose a sanction of $10,000 per day until Mr. Trump complies in full with the subpoena. And that was awarded. Accordingly, Mr. Trump has willfully disobeyed a lawful order of this court. In short, the affidavit provided the court with no basis to find that the search had been a thorough one or that it had been conducted in good faith effort to provide those necessary records to plaintiffs. Not only did Mr. Trump fail to submit an affidavit himself, which this court believes would have been the best practice, as he is the most obvious person to affirm where any responsive documents in his possession, custody, and control would be located, but the attorney affirmation submitted on behalf of Mr. Trump contained only conclusory statements rather than the details of a diligent search. Now, when this order came out, Trump's order, the soon-to-be disbarred and intellectually deficient Alina Habba said, well, it looks like all we have to do is file an affidavit, reading that paragraph that I just described. So that would be true if Trump weren't lying. She accidentally said the quiet part out loud, right? It will not surprise you to learn that despite her accidentally admitting to that in public, they're not going to file the affidavit because Donald Trump would like not to further perjure himself in this court. They are instead going to appeal the order because, of course, they are. So keep on the lookout for that. But that was a rare instance of candor by the by Trump's lawyers in saying, yeah, no, if we had honestly done the search, the court said all we would need is an affidavit from Mr. Trump. And there was that initial, like, I'm sure we could get that.
Yeah, I'll be right back. Let me.
And then she went to talk to the client.
Let's go talk to the big guy.
Donald Trump was like, Alina, I thought I told you, we're lying. I'm not submitting any affidavits.
She comes back hat in hand. So don't have it. What was the other option? Let's do that.
Donald J. Trump is held in contempt of this court, must pay a fine of $10,000 per day from the date of this decision and order until he purges such contempt as to the satisfaction of this court. And as we know from our discussions on Alex Jones, that he can petition to get some or all of it back, the court can decide not to. So I am super interested in continuing to watch this. This was.
I hope that court doesn't give it back and buys a golden toilet with it.
Me too. So that's update number one. Update number two, we went through the Marjorie Taylor Greene hearing. Briefs are being submitted as we record this. So it'll be next week before we can say.
I can't wait to get your hands on them, Andy.
Yeah. I can say publicly exactly what we predicted would happen has already happened, and that is that we know that the petitioners, the voters seeking to disqualify Marjorie Taylor Greene, have submitted at least the MTG tweet to, MTG text message to Mark Meadows of, can't the president declare martial law? M-A-R-S-H-A-L-L. Reminds me of a great Transformers quote where Megatron is like, I declare martial law and I am the marshal. except that, you know, she did it unintentionally. So we know that's happening. We'll be through all the briefs next week. We got a good question on Patreon, and I wanted to tackle it and explain it here because it wasn't one of the things we went into any depth in our recording. And that was with regarding her mindset. Haven't finished listening yet, so maybe you come back to this. Wouldn't the most optimistic interpretation be this? It doesn't matter what her mindset was, because it doesn't matter if she intended to aid, assist, lead, or et cetera, an insurrection. What matters is that she did in fact do those things, and she could have done so either accidentally or intentionally.
Man, that's weird. I thought I asked that, or maybe it was on my list and I didn't get to it, but I thought it was part of my, like, why is she, what do we even need her here for? You know, I think it was part of those questions, kind of.
And the answer is that the section of Section 3 of the 14th Amendment has not been well litigated, right? So we don't fully know what participating in an insurrection means. And the more that you demonstrate intent, the more that seems to be participation in the insurrection. So consider the following examples. I run a restaurant on the Mason-Dixon line, and I bring in and give aid and comfort to Confederate soldiers in their Confederate uniforms, and we put them up for the night in the bedroom upstairs, and we feed them. And that's clearly aid and comfort to the enemy, which is the precise text of the language in the 14th Amendment. And I suppose that the Confederate soldiers, you know, steel union uniforms, right? Now they come in, they've got a little bit of a twang in their accent, but you know, they're dressed in union blues. They say they're a part of the union army, and I do the same thing. I could very plausibly say, like, well, no, my intent was obviously not to give aid or comfort to enemies of the state, be they foreign or domestic. I thought I was helping our soldiers, our boys in blue. That may be overly simplistic, but if you're asking me as the plaintiff's attorney, I would not want to, at the end of the day, say that Marjorie Taylor Greene was a dupe or an idiot or inadvertently gave aid and comfort to the enemy. I would want to say, no, this is, she knew what she was doing because it's not clear what conduct rises to that level. Now, look, we certainly have, I mean, we've talked about in the 1920s, you know, being a socialist, publicly advocating socialism was sufficient to be considered aiding insurrection, giving aid or comfort to the enemies of the United States. So I get the basis for the argument, but if I were the lawyer, that's why I would want to be drilling down on she knew what she was doing.
All right. Well, at long last, I think we've got to call it to a close here.
Yep.
And move on.
Oh, no associate of this firm has ever failed the bar exam.
No kidding.
And now it's time for T3BE. Not doing well so far. I think I want to say I'm like 1 for 4 on the new latest set of questions.
Yeah, it's either 1 for 3 or 1 for 4.
Yeah.
Let's say 1 for 3. Not great, but I have a fantastic...
Getting close to a margin call on this if I just keep answering these wrong.
I have a fantastic real property question that I'm sure will get you back in the saddle
cool.
again. All right. Thomas, a mother who was the owner in fee simple of Blackacre, validly executed and conveyed the land to her daughter via quitclaim deed. Her daughter paid no consideration and failed to record the deed. 6 months later, the mother asked the daughter to rip up the deed and stated that she instead wanted to keep the land. The daughter voluntarily destroyed the deed. 1 week later, the mother and the daughter were killed in an accident because it's the bar exam. They both died intestate. The heirs of the mother and the heirs of the daughter both claim title to Blackacre. Who has title to Blackacre? A, the mother's heirs because the daughter never recorded her interest in the land. B, the mother's heirs because the daughter ripped up the deed. C, the mother's heirs because the daughter did not give valid consideration in exchange for the land. Or D, the daughter's heirs because the daughter never effectively passed title of the land back to the mother.
Well, cool, Andrew. This is proof that sanctity of the game. I'm going to get margin called on this exam. Okay. Tricky, as always. It's real property, so, you know, it's going to be tough. Quitclaim deed. Quitclaim deed. I feel like the deed is important, and in the past, the recording the deed has been, like, weirdly less important unless there's, like, a timing issue. It's so hard. It's so hard to keep all this straight. But right now, my instinct is toward the mother. Not only that, the mother's heirs is 3 of the 4 answers. So that's some probability there. Let's see. Who has title? The quitclaim deed, it was never recorded. No consideration, which I don't think matters, but we'll see. Never recorded, and she ripped up the deed. So in a lot of ways, nothing happened. Like if you give someone a quitclaim deed, they never record it. Tree falls in forest, they don't make the sound, and then they tear it up. It's almost like nothing happened. So that biases me a bit toward the mother, but I don't know, maybe not. Daughter destroyed the deed, and then they both die instantaneously at the same time, apparently, we'll say. So whose heirs essentially get the thingy? A, the mother's heirs because the daughter never recorded her interest in the land. I'm not sure if I like that answer because B, the mother's heirs because the daughter ripped up the deed. Those are interesting to think about, the differences there. Because let's say she'd got that quitclaim deed and then she recorded the interest. And then let's say the mother asked the daughter to rip up the deed. Would that mean that the mother didn't have it because she had recorded it? Maybe. Versus she doesn't record it. She doesn't rip up the deed. Yeah, I think I like B for reasons that I'm sure are not totally clear. But going through the logic of these answers, I think I like B over A. Because, like, just substituting in kind of the necessary things there, had the daughter not ripped up the deed, I feel like she has a stronger case that it's the daughter's than had the daughter recorded her interest, if that makes sense. C, the mother's heirs because the daughter did not give valid consideration. I think C doesn't matter. I don't think you need consider. This is not a contract, I don't think. This is just like, here's my land, which I think you can just do. So I think C's a not even attractive distractor. It's kind of it's a five, you know. D, the daughter's heirs because the daughter never effectively passed title of the land back to the mother. Now that's interesting. You never know with real property, could be shenanigans. But if you're able to pass the property with a quitclaim deed that isn't recorded, and yet you're not able to undo that by just destroying the quitclaim deed that was never recorded, that would be weird. It would be like a weird one-way thing. Feels like D would be like if she did record it, but then tore up the deed and then like nobody, they didn't record that. Like maybe D would make more sense. I think D is somewhat plausible. I think I'm between A, B, and D. And so I've even been on a bad second chance streak lately. So it kind of matters which ones I eliminate between A, B, and D. With D, it's weird. The only thing I can think of is like, okay, a quitclaim deed passes land to somebody, but to pass it back, maybe the daughter, instead of just ripping up a deed, would need to have made another deed back to the mother. That's possible. I don't know. I just don't, real property is so dumb and I never can understand it. So maybe what I said is garbage, but that's at least a possible explanation for that, that merely just ripping up. Cause like, I don't know, if you leave your deed out in the rain and you can't tell what it says anymore, do you just lose the property? Maybe. I don't know. Maybe real property is pretty weird. There is such a thing as playing for pink slips. That seems to be adequate. I think that's an old timey movie reference that I can't remember. Racing for pink slips. What's that? That's some old movie. Anyway, I think I'm between B and D. And because it's worded as a quitclaim deed, I think in my mind that means it's like a magic, that's like Monopoly deeds. Like you need to have the deed. The deed matters. You've never recorded it. All we have is the deed. I think the mother's heirs because the daughter ripped up the deed. I'm going with B. I'm between B and D. I'm going with B. Can't wait to have to pay a margin on this or whatever. Margin call.
And if you want to pay a margin call, you know how to do that. Just play along with Thomas. Share out this episode on social media. Include the hashtag T3BE. Include your guess, your reasons. Therefore, we will pick a winner and shower that winner with never-ending fame and fortune. Fame and fortune not guaranteed.
And thank you.
And now it's time to thank our new patrons at patreon.com/law. Hopefully you're enjoying that Lot Awful Movies Q&A coming up. We've got ad-free episodes each and every episode, early episodes, all the great stuff. And I'll start us off. So thank you to, yes, that Chris. Oh. Tyriel, a struggling medical student obsessed with the law. Ooh. Josh, the geologist. We got a lot of different occupations here. Laura Shaw and Eric M. Thank you, fine folks. Why don't you thank the second group there, Andrew?
And thank you, too. I became a Patreon to give a shout out to Kelly. Hi, Kelly. Well, yeah. Hi, Kelly. Absolutely use Patreon as a way of communicating to your loved ones who also listen to this show. Jason McIntyre, Alex Boyer. I, Andrew Torres, affirm that Thomas Smith is a legal genius and I will defer to his legal expertise. Yes, you can also use it to make me say stuff like that. To Wallace E. Punk and Scotty Sauce Fingers. Now I want chicken wings, right? Like I think sauce fingers, I think, you know, good, overly saucy, super hot chicken wings. I'm down. Thank you all so much for supporting the show. I'm going to leave and go get some chicken wings now.
And that's our show. That's our bonus show. Our bonus two-parter. Gosh, wow. If you're hearing this, I somehow got all this done and didn't die. So that's nice.
We recorded a trim 135 minutes on this subject. Yeah,
turning around in mere hours, but that's okay. Love the listeners. I think this was so valuable. I learned a ton from this deep dive. I'm glad we did it. Thanks, Andrew, for all the research, and thanks for listening. We'll see you now for real next episode with Andrew Seidel.
Until then.
I move for a bad court thingy.
You mean a mistrial?
Yeah, that's why you're the judge and I'm the law talking guy.
This has been Opening Arguments with Andrew and Thomas. If you love the show and want to support future episodes, please visit our Patreon page at patreon.com/law. If you can't support us financially, it would be a big help if you leave us a 5-star review on iTunes, Stitcher, or whatever podcast delivery vehicle you use. And be sure to tell all your friends about us. For questions, suggestions, and complaints, email us at openarguments@gmail.com. The show notes and links are on our website at www.openargs.com. Be sure to join the Facebook group at facebook.com/groups/yodelmountain and follow us on Twitter at @openargs. This podcast is a production of Opening Arguments Media, LLC, all rights reserved. It is produced with the assistance of transcriptionist Heather Loveridge, production assistant Ashley Smith, and additional contributions from Morgan Stringer and Deborah Smith. Special thanks to Teresa Gomez, who runs our live shows and heads up the OA Wiki. Follow at OA Wiki on Twitter. Additional thanks to the moderators of the Opening Arguments Facebook community: Emily Waters, Alicia Cook, Eric Brewer, Natalie Newell, Brian Ziegenhagen, and Teresa. And finally, thanks to Thomas Smith, who edits the show and created the fabulous theme music, which was used with permission.